All right. Well, Ben, welcome to the Bainbridge podcast.
Thanks so much, Ben. Great name. Happy to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
All right. Well, today it's Ben Zeisis from Super Angel, who literally is the Super Angel of e-com investors. It's incredible. Your portfolio is fantastic. Your network is fantastic. We're lucky enough to be a part of it. But I thought instead of me trying to butcher your background, if it would be super helpful to just sort of give a little bit about how you got to where you are, you know, why you are interested in angel investing, and then we'll take it from there.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Yeah, I guess just to step back, I definitely fell into this a little sort of organically. I grew up in New York City. I've always been an entrepreneur. I had a DJ business in even elementary school and started a college business. And after graduating from Boston University, came back to New York City. And my first sort of job was in the real estate area. I was doing store leasing and hired by owners to rent out their vacant retail spaces, hired by tenants to go and find space to open up storefronts. My first client was Verizon Wireless. They said, hey, go find us 10 stores. We want to, you know, expand our footprint in Manhattan. And I used to play roller hockey. So I got on my rollerblades at night when it wasn't so full of traffic. And I started just quickly skating around the city looking for vacant retail spaces. And it was just such an inefficient model. And just being an entrepreneur, I couldn't understand for the life of me why it wasn't as easy to look for storefront space and retail like it was to search for an apartment or a home on Zillow or StreetEasy. And so this idea just couldn't get out of my head. And I think other entrepreneurs oftentimes, you know, that you experience the problem yourself and it's like a seed and it just grows and grows. And so, you know, I was doing this like traditional retail leasing brokerage business during the day and at home and nights and weekends, just thinking about, hey, I really want to, you know, digitize this industry that's just old fashioned. And so I conceived the idea for what became RetailMLS.com, the first multiple listing service to search and advertise for vacant retail space. And I went out and I spoke to some of the investors and, you know, teams behind Zillow and StreetEasy, and was fortunate to get Spencer Raskoff, the CEO of Zillow, one of the co-founders, as an advisor. And so from 2010, basically, to 2014, I pursued this startup, and it was really my founder journey. And I went out and I raised money from angels and seed funds. And I, you know, as a non-technical founder, I went out and found a CTO, and, you know, at the time, a lot of custom software development. I spent 4 years, and I launched the product, tremendous sort of traction and users, and had mall owners and landlords and brokers all around the country using the platform for its intended purpose, to advertise and search for vacant retail space. And I'm giving the whole story here, Ben, in case
awesome.
Our listeners want to really go back and sort of understand, you know, my full sort of background. And I went through this 4 year journey of tons of, you know, wins and losses, ups and downs, constantly sort of on the flywheel as a founder. And as much success as I had from the product standpoint, I made it. I didn't want to create friction to obtain users. So I made the service free for both the advertisers and the searchers, the supply and the demand of the marketplace. And I went out and I was very excited to pitch every VC across Silicon Valley. And I was fortunate to be put in front of all the tier one, tier two, all the big name firms. And, you know, you leave these meetings, you feel so hopeful. But the truth is, I really didn't know what I was doing. And I think I sort of was pitching all wrong. Long story short, I couldn't get a Series A check for a handful of reasons. You know, maybe the list a little bit too long to go into the details. But, you know, single founder, non-technical, sort of went through the first 2 million, didn't yet really have material revenue. And people felt like it was a little binary. And, you know, I just didn't get to revenue or profitability soon enough. And certainly a lot of lessons learned. But long story short, in 2014, eventually I closed the business and it was really tough. I was, you know, a young professional in Manhattan. I sort of took my founder shot really early, well before a lot of my friends. And I was really down and out. But at the time, mid late 20s, I was an early customer of Dollar Shave Club and just an early adopter, a super fan. And clearly their marketing video was so unique and different than anything I'd ever seen. And I was just enamored by what they were doing. And ultimately, I randomly came across two young guys who I heard about that were building, looking to do the similar playbook as Dollar Shave Club, but for the toothbrush and the oral care industry. And just total randomness, met two founders at a party and heard what they were doing. And it just, everything made sense to me. Having seen what Dollar Shave Club was doing and, you know, being in the ecosystem, it just became clear that there was a similar opportunity to disrupt a legacy everyday, you know, consumer product category. And so Simon and Bill, these two incredible young gentlemen, pitched their idea to me. They came into my office and I fell in love with them and their mission, their vision. And I said, hey, I'm going to scrape together all the, you know, any money I could, even though I had put my last dollars into my own startup as it was sort of that ship was sinking. I just scrounged together, you know, a $10,000 check. And I said, hey, let me sort of introduce you to my network. And I think I can help a little bit with your pitch deck and introduce you to, you know, some of the people that can help bring this to life. And so that's what started the next 5-10 years of sort of what led to what I do today, this small angel investment in the business that became Quip. At the time, they didn't even have a name. It was a prototype. And that's the origin story, if you will. And I'll take a break. Maybe you've got some questions, but that kicked off as my very first angel investment, you know, what's now my future and my everyday profession.
Man, that is awesome. That is a great founder story. And I love that you started with your own startup and went through the pain and the trials and tribulations of that. I think I can definitely empathize. And also, I think a lot of founders can empathize with that. You know, oftentimes when you're pitching VCs or money, you know, it's rare that you get a founder on the other side of the table, right? Often you get.
I say it all the time, and some people have taken offense to it as far as, you know, the comment that, like, you know, the best VCs are maybe former founders. And I'm not going to say such a general statement, but I do think clearly having been a founder and going through that experience, I do believe makes me a better investor. I know there's examples out there, the most notable of which I think Fred Wilson, you know, where you can be, you know, a successful, arguably the most successful angel VC without having gone through a full founder journey. But I definitely think it provides incredible context to truly understand what founders are going through.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's super helpful. That must play to your advantage with the rapid growth of Super Angel, because, I mean, you went from Quip to this incredible portfolio. It seems really quickly. I don't know. I guess it probably took you a lot longer than it appears, but...
Yeah, right. 10 years for an overnight success. Yeah, so just to sort of continue on my journey there. So again, I didn't have any background in e-commerce, you know, where I was working at an e-commerce brand or doing marketing or supply chain or any number of these specialties within, obviously, the consumer e-com. I was just a consumer like anyone else and felt like I had a right to an opinion of a product as much as anyone. And I do think there's some attributes with Quip that have carried through today, one of which just, you know, unique design as a way to cut through the clutter. And I think if you were to look through the Super Angel Fund portfolio, you would notice that so many of my businesses, I truly over-index on design. The founders of Quip were industrial engineers, product designers, and painstakingly obsessed over every single whether it was a part of the physical toothbrush product or the branding or the copywriting or even the naming exercise. It was an exhaustive process. And, you know, I still believe design is an underappreciated piece of the puzzle, and one where I really give a lot of weight to, again, both if it's a hardware product or even software. I just think, you know, you can stand out and, separate yourself from competition with incredible design. I have a lot of respect for designers. And it's something that I certainly attribute that I look for in both brands and software from a user interface standpoint. So that first investment in Quip really kicked the ball rolling. And I fell in love with sort of championing other founders and sort of it was incredible day when Simon from Quip sort of told me that they were raising the Series A round, and from an incredible fund, and because I had sort of not gotten to that point on my own, so sort of living through their success, he knew how important that was and how meaningful it was to me. And I just started to, I went back to work after my startup didn't work out at a traditional real estate investment and property management firm as the sort of a chief operating officer role, and, you know, continued sort of my day job for the next several years in this real estate business. But all of my time, nights and weekends, before work and after work, I spent supporting Quip, but also starting to meet other founders who were building consumer product companies. I mean, I wasn't shy about the role I was playing with Quip because I was obviously investing a little bit more as over time in them, but bringing in my network to also invest in that business. And so people, you know, word of mouth starts to spread. Hey, Ben is an angel investor in consumer products. Hey, you know, and people would just start introducing me, and incredible consumer brand founders just started to reach out, and I spent time networking and started to place other pretty small investments into a lot of other brands. And so from 2014 to 2020, I think it was a few, I continued investing in Quip's rounds over some subsequent periods, but eventually I sort of expanded into other brands, Lalo, a baby goods company, Caraway, a cookware brand, you know, a cold email from the founder of Caraway. Hey, Ben, saw you were an investor in Quip. You know, it's high design consumer product company. Maybe you're interested in Caraway. We're looking to do a similar playbook, but reinvent, you know, this other, you know, business. And, you know, obviously a lot of luck involved. The harder you work, obviously, yeah, I believe the luckier you get. And I started to write small checks, even into some other people's syndicates as a way to learn, including Jason Calacanis, you know, huge mentor of mine, someone I follow. And I think anyone who's an angel investor, it's the first place you want to go to sort of get your bearings is read and listen to his book and podcast. But I basically invested in 32 companies personally over the 6 years from 2014 to 2020. You know, it's quite a lot of money. I mean, I put almost over $500,000 into 32 wow. companies. Any money I was making from my real estate business and my day job, where I had some success of buying and selling some buildings in Manhattan with others, I decided to put into early stage companies. And no question, a financial advisor would have said, this is not your best approach here. But I think everyone knows, you know, if you're looking to achieve tremendous upside, you know, risk and reward go hand in hand. And I'm certainly willing to, you know, with the ambitions I have financially, you know, I knew I needed to take more risk than others. And so I really tripled and quadrupled down on these early stage companies. And so 32 investments, truly almost $1 million of my own money. That was my track record, and just was extremely selective, but very fortunate. Great brands. Another one, Brightland. I mean, just incredible founders, Cadence. The list sort of goes on. And so 2020 hits, and I'm working full time in my real estate business and really full time as well, supporting my founders. And I decided, really, like a lot of people, the you know, pandemic was the great reassessment. And I really looked at myself in the mirror and I said, I want to do what I love full time professionally. And I just, my wife and I just had our first daughter, and it was clearly another tremendous risk. And I had to sort of go through the pros and the cons with her and sell her on this concept. But looking around, looking in the mirror, I said, you know, I really want to do what I love, and spoke to my real estate partner at the time and said, you know, I'm going to step back from this business and I'm going to go full time and raise a fund. And really, you know, I wish there was another way to sort of do it, but you need to raise a fund generally, unless you've got unlimited capital, which no one has, as a way to sort of earn management fee until you can, you know, I don't know if there is no end game, but really until you sort of achieve those exits, which come many years down the road. So in January 1st of 2021, my fund launched SuperAngel.fund, and, you know, started to get going and, you know, be able to leverage both my own money. You know, I invest in the fund, of course, and the network that I established, people started investing with me, and was off to the races.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Did you consider going to work for another fund, or was it always going to be your own?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I would say I had some conversations with several funds. And again, most of the my first sort of 32 personal angel investments were primarily e-commerce brands. And so, you know, I had co-invested with tremendous funds and other great people. And so was exploring conversations with several of them. Not for any reason. I just decided, let me try doing this myself as what's called a solo GP. And, you know, a platform like AngelList, which I'm sure maybe some of our listeners are aware of, they enable people like me as an individual to sort of create a fund while they handle all of the back office administrative services, the tax and legal and banking stuff. And so I would say, if not for AngelList, maybe I would have worked at another fund. But in this case, because they serve such an incredible purpose and handle all those functions, it enables me and other great investors to sort of not partner necessarily with other people to perform those services. I mean, I'd also just like to say, I do believe early stage investing, pre-seed, seed, and this is not to say that, you know, funds with multiple partners, there's a lot of ways to be successful, but I believe it's a single woman or man sport and best served as such because it's so qualitative and we're underwriting the founder that if I meet a founder, you know, and I'm, it's all my own experiences that are driving my conviction. If I have to go, if I get conviction in an investment and then need to go sell it into another one or two or three other people, A, you lose momentum. You know, deals move quick at the earliest stage, especially if you want to get in at that very lowest, you know, cap or price. You know, that would really, in my mind, not serve, you know, to be the best approach. And I think, you know, being able to just move really quickly and founders know I'm the sole decision maker, I think there's a lot of value there. And so, you know, I'm a solo GP, but I would say I work so closely with some of these other funds that invest in the areas that I invest. And, you know, it's as if we're, you know, working together almost.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. That is a terrific backstory. And how many brands are you in today now? You're in like, what, 40 or 50?
That's probably right. And, you know, brands were the core focus of my portfolio in the earlier sort of years. And eventually, I think, like a lot of investors who did consumer product companies, you know, the market became so saturated and it just became harder to stand out. And so I expanded into the e-commerce SaaS and sort of the companies that are supporting the brands and the services and the software and the tools that these brands were using to run their business. And so it was a natural evolution and expansion, because catching up with all my brand founders when two or three or four are saying, hey, Ben, like we're using Settle for cash flow management, you know, accounts payable. This is an amazing tool. You should take a look at it. It made sense to sort of spend time there and start to learn about, hey, maybe I can invest in, you know, everyone says the picks and shovels, if you will, people selling, you know, shovels to the brands digging for gold. So it became a huge focus of my criteria were to invest in these e-com SaaS tools, which has made up a larger and larger portion of my investing portfolio over the years. But I'd say I have about 100 total portfolio companies. And I think, you know, maybe there's 40 or 50 brands in there, maybe 30 tools. And then I also invest in prop tech, given my experience investing, both founding a real estate tech company and then working in the real estate business. So every investor, I think, likes to invest where you have a competitive advantage and either information, network, experience. And for me, you know, I'm no different. Those are the areas. But I would say, you know, I've got those core sort of pillars and categories, but you always have to be open-minded to found, you know, if there's an amazing founder in a space that maybe isn't the strict core focus of my fund, you know, it's always possible I'll invest.
Nice.
Founder led.
Well, you have an incredible view of the market. You know, if we sort of focus on the brands, right? Because I think a lot of our listeners are brand leaders, founders. So you have like roughly 50 that you kind of know intimately, and then you've got this awesome deal flow. You know, I would argue that you have a better view of the market than really anybody that I could think of. So given that perspective, what have you seen over the past couple of years? Because, you know, obviously D2C and e-com has gone through like some incredible shifts since you've started investing. And so I'd love to hear your perspective on that evolution.
Yeah, I think, you know, clearly you can't just, you know, put up, you know, grab a product off the shelf from a manufacturer in China and throw up a Shopify website and, you know, place some Facebook or Instagram or Google ads. That model is over. You know, it worked great for a while and for good reason. I mean, you're sort of just, you know, taking advantage of cost-effective eyeballs. I mean, that's what it's about in this game, right? Your acquisition costs, making sure, you know, you can earn enough to cover, you know, with your lifetime value of these customers, making sure you're not overspending to, you know, spending basically $2 to get $1 of revenue. And I think there's some poster childs that have gotten public that have just, you know, it's crazy that they were even able to sort of get funding for so long and overfunded, for, you know, I think you that was the big, that was the, no, there's no reason to name any specifics. But overfunding, I think if you were to pinpoint what the primary sort of cause was for the businesses, the quote D2C darlings, the early ones, they got overfunded and you simply lose discipline no matter who you are. If someone hands you, you know, several hundred million dollars or more and your business just simply like you sort of need to invest it. Like you're not just going to like put it in the savings account and you're going to hire people and create new products, open more stores, and obviously you sort of run out of things to do, if you will, and you just lose discipline. And what I've found, clearly pattern recognition is a huge part of what an investor, you know, builds up in their mind, you know, as far as what works and what doesn't is, you know, in my experience, the best companies, and again, best being defined as like reaching profitability and creating shareholder value that's sustainable, have, you know, really struggled to raise money and didn't get money thrown at them from a lot of the name brand VCs. I mean, so many of the companies in my portfolio, it's almost a little bit of luck is that like the big VCs like turned them down. I mean, we could go down the list. And they simply have to figure out a way to do more with less. And there's just no shortcuts and there's just no other way around it. If you're forced to figure out a way to survive with less, you know, you'll figure it out. And yeah. So overfunding, I think, was a big problem. But today, to stand out as a brand, I mean, I think there's some, you know, there's table stakes today. Like you've got to have an amazing product and it has to have an incredible, you know, depth to it with the story and the mission and the vision and sustainability and, you know, maybe influencers or celebrities to help, you know, that are on the cap table, not just paid, right? But they've got vested interests. I mean, a great example is this beer company, and I do very little food and beverage, but I'm an investor in 8 Beer, Troy Aikman's new beer company. I think one of the biggest differences, there's so many brands that'll pay, you know, a celebrity a ton of cash, a ton of equity to promote the brand, but it's not authentic. And, you know, they'll do a few posts, they'll show up for a few media events, but, you know, that's sort of it. They're getting paid cash up front. It doesn't even matter what the, you know, the value of the equity is because they've sort of already made their money. But this beer company, Eight, I mean, Troy Aikman is, you know, equal co-founder with the others. I mean, he's so committed to this. It was just a unique circumstance where it was so authentic. He was just part of the team from the earliest days. And, you know, he and 3 other co-founders, it's a really diverse team with 4 co-founders with distinct skill sets in different core areas where you need to have, you know, your eyes fully open. Great operations, great product person who came from the alcohol industry, you know, a great financial mind in the C-suite, in the co-founder level. So I think some of the brands that have gotten to trouble, again, besides from overfunding, just lacked financial discipline. And that actually sort of brings us into what excited me about investing in Bainbridge is there's so many moving parts and, you know, different, I say every expense is a variable expense, right? I mean, we talk about fixed expenses and variable expenses, right? Everyone wants to, when they're doing their model, okay, well, you know, this will be the cost for this, you know, across the next 5 years. So let's just worry about the variable expenses, but everything's always changing, right? Yeah. And so you need to be living in your financial model, constantly evaluating every single line item and, you know, figuring out the profitability, every product, every distribution channel, right? I mean, there's just so many variables. You can't, and if you're a single founder, it's even harder, right? Because you're managing so many other aspects. So, multiple founders has always been, you know, smart to sort of divide and conquer. But there's also, I happen to have a handful of solo founders that run successful brands. And to be honest with you, I have no idea how they do it. You know, when I tell you they don't sleep, I mean it. They rely on advisors and great other team members, clearly. But so I think it's every business is hard, right? But running a consumer brand today, that's got to be up there.
I love where you've taken this because I think that is so true. I think a lot of founders don't realize the operational complexity of the businesses that they've embarked on, and they kind of are getting to realize it. But I mean, it's so much harder than any other business I can think of. I mean, you have these cash conversion. I'm buying stuff and then I'm selling it. I've got these massive cash needs, right? I've got to manage that. I've got my unit economics and my margin structures you're talking about. I've got my repeat, purchase cycle that I've got to figure out. And then I've got customer acquisition. All of these move at different cadences. They all have different metrics, different data sources. And it's like, being able to combine all those to understand how the machine really works is hard enough. And then I don't think people appreciate the importance of like little improvements in those flywheels.
Oh yeah. One little adjustment here, there, you decrease, you just got to find margin everywhere you look. You know, that's renegotiating all your contracts with, the shipping providers, and it's just you always need to be improving and finding ways to, increase top line, decrease expenses, to be successful. And even still, you got to get lucky and you got to find good places of arbitrage to find cheap eyeballs, constantly evaluating and testing and iterating. I mean, like anything in life, right? You're always doing that. But
is that one of the things that you look for in founders, that, they have that ethos?
Yeah, no question. So, I mean, my criteria, there's no financial model or, as far as people ask me, how do you decide if you're going to make an investment? And, you're not just plugging in some variables or data points into model and spitting out a yes or no. There's so many, you're collecting all these dots, all these signals, running them through an imperfect algorithm in my head. And then ultimately you're sort of making a decision. But for me, my sort of investing criteria, there's three core sort of pillars. The first, clearly the founders and the team. And that weighs the most heavy of everything. I mean, I'm talking, maybe 90% or more. Of the selection criteria. And within that, it's really figuring out, is this a person who has unwavering ambition to build what I say a multi-billion-dollar company? Of course, I'm thrilled if I invested a $5 million valuation and you sell at 100 or 200. But let's be honest, we're angel investing here, right? Risk reward. We're looking for founders to build unicorn valuations and value creation. And so founders who are thinking really big and who have just, again, unwavering ambition and drive to get there. The second thing I call out within, when I'm looking at a founder is a relentless pursuit of perfection, laser focus and product obsessed, right?
Wow.
And it's really, these are very thought out sort of buzzwords that I'm using here, but just think about that, right? Like, these are patterns I've seen. And by the way, I totally understand that, you know, what is it? Good is the enemy of great. Like, you need to ship it. You know, you can't wait till something's perfect until you sort of ship it. However, you can't put a product in front of, you know, dozens, hundreds, thousands, millions of consumers that isn't going to live up to standards. I mean, that you're done. If you sell a toothbrush that's not properly going to, you know, effectively work or brush teeth, or like, you're done, your business is done. And so it's one of those things where, you know, the first impression sort of really does matter. I mean, you know, I've just heard of a founder who sort of, you know, his first product run, there were some defects, and he's so early. I think, you know, he's quickly shifting and getting that fixed, but, you know, you make too many of those mistakes and you're totally done. So, you know, sort of just continuously pursuing perfection, right?
Yeah.
And staying laser focused and being obsessed with their product, I've found repeatedly is just a trait that, you know, lends itself to a successful company at the end of the day. But the third thing, right? So the first being the unwavering ambition, the pursuit of perfection, product obsessed. The third thing is really important. Because oftentimes as young founders, although not always, you're not an expert. I mean, you know, you've had so much experience in your career. So the key is ability to learn new things and absorb information fast, right?
Yeah.
I mean, again, that's just what I've seen. I tell a story, you know, I'll give you an example of that. But, you know, you got to quickly get smart into what we were talking about earlier. So many areas of your business, right? You know, the finance department, the legal department, the HR department, the marketing department, the supply chain department, the research and development department. So you're not going to know these things going in. So you need the ability to learn those things and absorb the information really quickly. And of course, delegate, right? And know enough to sort of assess and evaluate talent to help you run those departments. One of my founders, he was a first-time founder. He was trying to figure out how does he compensate new team members. And, you know, he was quickly trying to figure out, you know, how options work and restricted stock and things like that. And I just remember, you know, speaking to this founder on a Friday, and he had no clue of how any of these things worked. But it's critical when you're hiring team members to incentivize them with, again, either options or restricted stock. And there's, for people that, you know, have been part of, we're able to, you know, have these ownership stakes, you know, and I'm sure people listening are like, yes, you know how complicated this is. And if you don't, you will, if you have any of these things. It is confusing, it is complicated, and it is important that you understand at least a general sense. And this founder on a Friday had never in his life experienced any of this. And I swear to God, by Monday, you know, he was educating the lawyer on how this works, because he spent all weekend literally just reading everything you possibly can on, you know, NSOs, ISOs, you name it, you know, and all the different implications in order to, you know, he needed to hire someone and they had asked him about these things. So I was blown away. And that was just one data point in my evaluation process. It was holy, I don't know if I can say shit, this guy just like became an expert in 48 hours that he went toe to toe with a top lawyer on schooling, you know, this person on, you know, how this all worked. So those That's are really awesome. The key criteria for founders. And then I obviously want to make sure it's a market. I have a unique ability to evaluate and assess because I'm not investing in crypto or biotech or life sciences. I just simply can't assess it. So I'll miss, surely there'll be a unicorn investment that gets sent to me, right? You know, because I get hundreds of deals a week that I'll just won't even be able, I'll simply pass without even exploring it because I wouldn't even know where to begin. You know, I'm investing in markets that I understand and can evaluate. And then if there is product or traction to be had at that point, because again, I invest often off of just a founder and an idea. So there might not even be a product or any traction to speak of. But if there is, you know, it's got to have to my earlier point, you know, cutting edge design and across all touch points. Like I want to see what the founder's vision is for their unboxing experience, the photography, right? Yeah. Positive unit economics, creative distribution tactics, right? Because we can't rely on paid media. So we got to figure out, are we using affiliate? Are we doing a partnership strategy? Are we going to put ads in mobile video games? I mean, whatever it is. So I've never given you my whole playbook. And by the way, my deck is at superangeldeck.com, and it lays all of this stuff out for those.
Oh, that's awesome. More.
Yes. I make all this stuff's public, superangeldeck.com. And so yeah, I invite anyone to check that out.
So if somebody sends in a deck that is basically your format, are you just like, oh, this is awesome?
What do you mean my format?
Like, that, like at the top of the pile that way.
What's that?
If they send in their deck in your format, are they like put right at the top of the consideration set?
Yeah. I mean, but again, there's not one thing, right? I've had founders that I've passed on investing in their business for a year, a brand founder, you know, I just kept passing, but this guy was relentless. He kept updating me every month, every few weeks, boom. Hey, we just made progress here, there, boom. And eventually I invested, you know, a meaningful amount and actually brought in probably the largest new investor. And so, you know, that's the thing. Like a lot of investors think that the decision-making is either like, yes, I'm an investor, no, but there's also this middle ground of not yet. Right. Like it's never black and white, right? Sure. Right. If you need to make a decision because there's a priced round happening and you sort of need to like today, you need to commit. Listen, those happen. And of course you sort of need to put up or shut up, but there's a lot of companies where it's, hey, not ready today, but like if you prove out X, Y, and Z over time, you never know. So I try and be really quick to tell founders who pitch me exactly where they stand, sort of what I need to see. And I think that, you know, resonates and part of why I'd like to think that founders keep, you know, coming to me with deal flow. And that's what it's about is, you know, just being a great investor. And we could always talk more about that. Actually, I've got a funny, I don't want to take up all the airspace here, but I was recently tweeting just, you know, what I realize makes me different than a lot of investors and even just in the top 10%, not to pat myself on the back, but I basically tweeted that just reading, period, puts me in the, you know, a lot of investors, they just don't read. Like you make the investment and you forget about it, but like, that's not what this business is about. That's when it starts. Just reading the updates and responding to the asks. You know, I know everyone's distracted and whatnot, but I just think you make a commitment to a founder to be part of their baby, their company. Again, unless you set expectations otherwise, but I just think the least you can do is sort of like read the updates, you know, reshare LinkedIn posts and, you know, even just like their Instagram posts. Just be a champion for founders. Because again, it's so hard to be a founder. My job, and I take it so seriously, is just try and move the needle in any way, shape, or form. Even if I'm just putting a smile on the founder's face, you know, by helping the algorithms show their content more, by liking and sharing. To me, that, you know, that's the least I can do.
Yeah, and it's noticed and appreciated. That's awesome. Hey, Ben, I want to dive into something you're talking about. Your focus on the founder's focus on product perfection, you know, and it sounds to me like you're kind of describing a premium. You're looking for founders that are trying to make a premium product. Is that a fair characterization?
For brands, for sure. I mean, it's yes, I did. But again, I one of my examples of a company I missed was this business Manscaped, know, and had a chance to invest in the very first round. And, you know, at the time I felt like the product was a little gimmicky, but I maybe should have, I'm not sure where the value of the business is today. But I know that they, you know, did, I mean, I think it's public, hundreds of millions of revenue and got to an incredible scale. And that was one where, you know, maybe I should have just relied more on just the founder, you know, than the product, just because if it was just an incredibly impressive founder who had some, you know, insights into creative distribution. Like they knew how to, you know, produce amazing engagement content that, I mean, I think their videos on YouTube are in the tens of millions, and that's a, you know, that's a superpower, right?
Yeah.
And sort of maybe is more weight than the incredible premiumness of the actual products, although I'm sure they've improved from when I first saw it. But that's why two quotes I have in my deck, one from Jason Calacanis, which was, I don't need to know if your idea is going to succeed. I need to know if you are. Right. Yeah. And I put that in my deck. And then the second one, which I just love. And again, these are like the best investors in the world. Keith Raboy tweeted a few months ago, the number one lesson of venture has always been, if you find an outstanding founder confronting a massive opportunity, don't ask any other questions. Wire money. And it's like, we can debate all day. Like, you can do all the diligence in the world that you want, but yeah. I just love, like, I'm sorry, like, go be a private equity investor if you want to be looking through cash flow models, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're doing, I don't know. We're, the podcast is not about one thing, but at least my, you know, again, what I do is angel investing, and it's just people. And you can, you know, I just think you're overcomplicating things if you start talking about too many other things. So I hopefully over time will, again, I aspire to be a super angel. I don't really, you know, I'm not going to give myself that title yet. I think there's so much more work to be done. But anyway, that's a little of my thoughts.
Well, I want to tie two things together, though, that you're the focus on the product and the quality of the product. And then you'd said at the very beginning, the importance of getting to a sustainable profitability. And do you think, you know, in your having seen so many deals, like, that founders are pricing their products appropriately to get to the margins they need to be successful and not totally relying on outside capital to, you know, hit the big exits?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, founders ask me, brand founders, all the time to sort of help with figuring out pricing. It's a critical, you know, decision point. And I'm not a pricing expert. I mean, I can always give them my opinion, but I always caveat with, like, you know, if you make sure you maybe want to talk to some other experts, but lean, I think, you just maybe start higher because you generally, you can't go up right after you set a price. And so I would always recommend, you know, starting high, and then you can always bring it down. But clearly that's one thing where your cash flow model, your unit economics comes into play, and figuring out, are you pricing it enough such that you can, you know, spend what you need to spend, and both on COGS and, you know, SG&A to get to the margins that both gross and net margins that you need to be to be successful in the long run. You know, one of my companies, maybe you know about, is it's called IntelliGems. It's an e-com SaaS tool. I think actually you share an investor with them, and they help brands figure out optimal pricing, and the founder has worked as engineers and data scientists, I think, at Via, which was the ride-sharing company, which, you know, was all about similar Uber, right? Your dynamic pricing for ride-sharing. What if we bring that to e-commerce and actually in real time A/B test different prices for products to different people, and, you know, let's and then clearly use the one that's resonating and achieving the best ultimate margins, right? And outcome. So I think that's a huge white space and ripe for companies like IntelliGems, and I think there's some others to figure that out. Fascinating, right? I mean, it makes common sense. Now, I don't think if you walked into a store, you couldn't sort of do that. But given sort of online digital, I'm not shopping with my friend next to me and we're both know what price is. And so, fascinating business, great founders, Drew and Adam, also backed by, you know, Vinyl and TJ. Yeah. And so I'm excited to see how they can support brands with pricing strategies. Yeah.
This is a conversation I think we were having increasingly with our customers, is like, you know, as we're looking at the margin structure, we're like, well, you know, are you priced appropriately? And I think there's a hesitation oftentimes with the founders because there's, you know, you're making a premium product, you know, price is an indication to the consumer of premium, right? Like, you don't walk into a Ferrari dealer and expect to pay $50,000 for a car. You're expecting to pay $250,000 or whatever it is, you know? So I think there's like a bit like of hesitation, you know, sometimes that gets in the way of really asking for the right price.
Yeah. And I think there's
easier if you start high and go, yeah, the margins are.
It's a critical decision point for founders. And I think, you know, the truth is you're going to need to price differently depending on the you know, the distribution channel, right? Because, you know, whether you're selling on Amazon or in big box, right? Target and Walmart and Costco and Home Depot and Lowe's, like you'll need to create different bundles and packages and get to different structures for maybe each of them sometimes and right. Price differently. So that, again, going back to everything being variable, you'll need to look at, you know, your cost structure and margin structure for each of the SKUs and the distribution channels independently and together holistically.
With that, everything is variable ethos, like our idea, but do you have any rules of thumb for OpEx?
Not really. I mean, you know, I know there's just like general frameworks, but I'm generally not, you know, too much tied to specifics there. You know, I recommend founders get on the phone with Bainbridge and work with you because you guys, I mean, that's what your specialty is. And that's, it's just critical, right? Like, and I think creating a bench, you know, benchmarking against what the other top performing brands are doing and a model where, you know, it's multiplayer where you can be entering in and viewing information alongside your VP of finance, alongside your head of performance, where everyone can see the numbers dynamically. To me, was what's so exciting about Bainbridge was, wow, we as a brand, this is arguably your most important priority is making sure you don't run out of money and that you are profitable with each customer and product that you sell. You know, so really spend time, you know, with either an outsourced CFO, because a lot of these brands obviously too early to pay for a full time. But then working with a tool like Bainbridge, clearly to, you know, put it in a format that's digestible, that's best practices. I mean, what you guys have done and what I've heard from your customers is really game changing.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Ben, what are you seeing, you know, what are you hearing from your founders coming out of like Q4 and the kind of view of their view of 2023? And what's your view of 2023?
Clearly, I think the market has slowed tremendously. At the later stage, more affected than the early stage. The early stage simply has time to sort of, you know, get to positive outcomes. So I think there's less of a valuation drops because there's a floor for pre-seed deals in some respect. But I think there's some, you know, there's everyone saying there's tons of VC money on the sidelines and eventually needs to get put out. Yes, but you just need to, as quickly as possible, get to profitability, cash flow positive, not relying on the raising the next dollar to sustain your business. If that means slowing growth, holding off on, you know, scaling to a new distribution channel this year, then so be it. You know, you need to live to fight another day. I mean, you just simply need to survive at least in the next 6 to 12 months. But grow sustainable. I mean, this is how it should have always been. But when these businesses were overfunded, they got ahead of themselves and, you know, were trading profitability for top line growth. So I think, you know, everyone kind of knows that, you know, quickly, just, you know, penny pinch, if you will, right? I'm not going to say cheap, but you just need to look at every single expense for your business, whether it's you're paying for Zoom and you get Google Meet built in, you know, maybe you get rid of Zoom or just use the free version. I think everyone's doing that. But I also think, and this is something that, you know, shouldn't be sort of new for this year. And I think it needed to have been put in place. The best brands were putting this into place a year or two ago, which is you really need to be omnichannel as a consumer product company and sell everywhere to everyone in some respects. We know that 85% of every dollar spent in, you know, on products is in store, right? Brick and mortar. And so, yeah, it's sexy to put up a website and, you know, call yourself an e-commerce brand, you're a software company, but no, you're selling a product. Where are people purchasing products? Well, 8 or 9 out of every 10 are in store. So what does that mean? That means get into a boutique, get into a regional, you know, one of my brands, Arbor. I mean, so smart. Clearly, they have a beautiful e-commerce website, one of the best you'll ever see. But so much of that is education and even, you know, candy for the buyers at the big boxes, where they can see the vision of, you know, what is this brand going to look like, you know, in our store. And so quickly getting in front of buyers at at the big boxes is an efficient way to, you know, and likely, you know, a more cost effective way to generate sales.
Yeah. I think that is a really interesting, I think that brands are starting to use D2C to kind of prove out their ability to hit a customer base, but also to prove out to the buyers at a Target or the mass retail that, like, hey, this works, you know, with this with this price point and these margins, you know, so they gain confidence to make those buys, because, you know, get like 2 cracks at it a year. So you got to really put, you know, because the buyer.
Oh, totally. Cycle, yeah, absolutely. Big retailers.
What are your thoughts about 2023? Like, you know, everybody's like, oh, are we going to have a recession? Or, you know, we watched like retail sales go down in December. I mean, that was like, holy, you know, I didn't realize they'd also gone down in November. So, like, you know, kind of where do you think 2023 is going to
go? Listen, I think, right, everyone knows, like, the American economy is consumer-driven. I'm worried about the amount of, you know, debt that's piling up. I think there was some stat that blew me away regarding – I need to verify this because it sounded so extraordinary. It's hard to believe that maybe, like, 7 out of every 10 purchases were done through, like, a buy now, pay later. Something like that. Maybe it's just online. I'm not sure what it was, but it was, you know, you can only kick the can down the curb so much. I mean, you know, you got to spend responsibly, and a little concern that people will slow down on physical products. I think we know that, you know, there's pent up demand for services and travel and hospitality, given people's being, you know, stuck at home for a few years for COVID. But, you know, businesses that are selling cookware, that are selling, you know, plant, home and garden stuff. I mean, these are still going to be, you know, maybe it was a $20 billion a year category. If it drops 5, 10, 15, 20%, it's still enormous. And if if you're a sort of emerging brand that's has a better premium product, being marketed better design, like, you'll keep taking share away from the legacy incumbents. And so, you know, maybe it stunts your growth slightly, but you'll still be growing year over year. So I'm not seeing, you know, people, I'm still seeing really strong growth from, you know, a lot of my brands. So it's nice. A tale of two worlds when, you know, you hear about the overall macro economy, but, you know, the investor updates are coming in strong. Maybe they're not as strong as they would have been with the tailwinds of the, you know, the cheap money and, you know, PPP and all that good stuff. But I do think, you know, someone was asking me the other day, they were a little bit down and out. They were told, hey, this is not a good year to start a business. They were told by someone. And I got on the phone. I was like, oh my God, you're getting the wrong advice. If you are a founder that has those attributes we talked about, I mean, and I know it from my own experience, you know, real founders are the best founders. Like, you can't not start your business, right? Like, you've got this pull inside of you where, like, it's just a gravitational pull. There's nothing that's going to stop you from starting your business and pushing forward and, you know, finding a way to willing it to make it happen. So if you are someone that has that, again, unwavering ambition, that drive, like, don't wait. start today. Yeah. I mean, come on, start today.
That's awesome advice. I'm going to put your feet to the fire for the last question. You said strong growth, and like, I think that we have this debate sometimes with founders, like, what is an acceptable level of growth now? Like, you know, you go back 2 years and people are like, oh, I'm growing like 400% a year or whatever. People are like, I at least need to double. And now everybody's like, well, you got to get to profitability. But everybody's like, but I still want to show growth. So what do you think, you know, kind of in the investor world is like an acceptable level? Or is it, there's, you know, is it okay just to be profitable?
Yes. Or flat? I mean, listen, even if you're not growing much, but there's some line of sight to growth. Maybe you pulled back on production because you need to tweak your brand and packaging to set yourself up for, you know, 2024 Walmart's line reviews, right? And so you need to, you know, take, you know your revenue is going to take a hit in the short term, but, you know, it's only going to, taking one step back to go two steps forward. So I think, you know, it's hard to sort of like give an exact response there. But I think you got, as from an investor, I'm looking at these things holistically. I will say, right, like the bar is so much higher. If you're just coming out of the gate today with a new brand, a new consumer product company, you're going to have a very hard time finding venture investors. I think you'll have more success with angels and friends and family. And sure, not everyone has friends and family, but other types of financing, or just go slower. I mean, advice for founders raising is, you know, put everyone you speak to on an email distribution list. And just as long as you keep making progress slow and steady, I mean, I think that's your best fundraising tactic is, you know, people are just skeptical and hesitant. Like, no one wants to make a decision. So like you bring people along for the journey with you. And if you show continued progress, you're de-risking the opportunity for everyone. Again, I think founders often think they need to wait until they have some, you know, monumental update before sharing news with people. But I don't agree. I think people appreciate and know that things take time, and great things, you know, even specifically the best things take time, right?
Yeah.
Delaying gratification, everyone says, is a way to success. Like, yeah, just make slow and steady incremental progress day over day, week over week. And keep your investors updated, or potential investors updated. And you never know. I think good things will happen.
Nice. Well, that's awesome advice, Ben. And I think we'll end there.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.